We will now embark on a new line of inquiry, the problem of the relationship of class and gender. Does everybody have an outline? I handed them out last time. I have a few extra just in case. If you could pass this down. Stephen, here's your comments if you want to pass that down to. We're going to embark on an extraordinary, I'll say this many times in the semester, I find so many of these topics just deeply interesting as intellectual problems. So once again, the relationship of class and gender is just a really interesting problem to figure out. Aside from the fact that it's of great social, moral, and historical, political importance. But even aside from that, just to think about deeply the question, how should we think through the problem of the interconnectedness between distinct forms of social relations in general, but in particular, distinct forms of relations that are bound up with issues of oppression and exploitation. Oppression, domination, exploitation, you know, the whole whatever particular word is most salient in your thinking about it. So here we have two kinds of social relationships, class relations and gender relations. They don't have a logically intrinsic connection. They're grounded in different aspects of social life, different problems that human societies and practices have to solve. And yet they're deeply intertwined. And how should we approach the problem of thinking about it? So there's a conceptual issue. And then when we're trying to explain various things, when we're trying to do our work as sociologists, social scientists, to explain the world, let alone our work as activists trying to transform the world, how does this interconnectedness impact, shape, constrain, enable different kinds of struggles and transformations? The trilogy of oppressions that dominates most discussions in the United States is race, class, and gender. They each have different logics. The efforts at various times to what, and the expression that was used, reduce one to another, to see one or another of these forms of oppression as mere reflections of another, that has been largely abandoned. Very few theorists today argue for the reducibility of one to another, although there still are legitimate arguments for the priority of one over another with respect to specific problem areas. To say that there's a global priority, for example, to say that class has primacy with respect to race and gender, regardless of the context and problem, seems a ridiculous proposition. And one that I think nobody actually defends. But it could be within the struggles over the state and the hegemony of particular political perspectives, it could be that the class problem is the problem that really is the thing that has to be solved, and race and gender issues need to adjust to the class problem, possibly. But maybe not. It could be, and arguments have been made, that in the American context, it remains the case that racial division is the division which blocks broader progressive changes, and that transcending that cleavage is the priority, primacy. That is, other priorities have to ask, how can we adjust our demands to facilitate that? I'm not defending any of those views, but I don't think those are illegitimate claims. It's not illegitimate to propose that with respect to some historical times and places, one or another of these forms of oppression needs to be central within political agendas, nor is it illegitimate to say with respect to certain explanatory problems, one or another might be more central. What I want to do in this lecture and in the lecture on Wednesday, and I suspect this will spill over until next week. I'm not going to try to go into rapid speech and try to get this all done within a single lecture just so that we don't fall further behind. I'm not going to push the double speed button on my recorder to pack in 4 hours of lectures in a two-hour period. So what I'm going to try to do is focus on the specificities of each of these kinds of oppressions, and in order for us to understand the logic of their interconnections. The focus is on, for both the gender and the race discussion, is on their interconnectedness with class. So I'm not going to attempt in a compact lecture to give a full-blown emancipatory account of gender or of race, but I have to do some of that in order to understand its articulation to class. The articulation of gender to class and race to class, I think, are foundationally different. I think it's a real mistake to, in the name of, which sometimes happens under the rubric of intersectionality, to just treat this as a kind of laundry list in which you have to take them all into account and they all interact and everything is just in the interaction without there being any distinction in the logic of interaction of these different kinds of relations. I think there's a fundamental difference between the way gender interacts with class than the way race interacts with class. To just give the simplest of stories, just to prefigure, race interacts with class largely between households. That is, you have racialized households occupying particular kinds of class positions, whereas gender intersects with class within households. Men and women live in families together, sharing as a household a particular relationship to the class structure. Now that just changed dramatically the whole problem of how class cleavages, race cleavages, and gender cleavages play themselves out. You rarely will have, it's not that it never happens, but it would be very rare to have a working class strike in which the husband's on strike and the wife is a strike breaker. Right? That, indeed, it's very rare to have strikes in which men are on strike and women are strike breakers, let alone spouses are strike breakers. It's not that that never happens, but it's pretty rare. It's not rare to have a white working class strike with black strike breakers. Historically, it's not so common now, but and that's because of this within household and between household distinction. And it's not just an accident that race and gender work differently with respect to that problem, which means that the relationship between these social divisions and how they reinforce or undercut each other and the problem of overcoming the divisions with respect to the tasks of forging solidarity are very different with respect to gender and race as they interact with class. So that's a kind of overarching context for thinking through the specificities of these relations. So let's begin. The first item on the outline is just a brief gesture towards the standard feminist critiques of class analysis. There are three kinds of criticisms that are part of the standard. This is sort of the standard off-the-shelf criticisms. This is less salient than it was probably 15 years or so ago. I think feminists are less preoccupied. There was a period where there was a lot of energy by feminists in defending feminist approaches against what were seen as Marxist alternatives. Now that's not such a theme, probably because Marxism itself is not such a looming presence in the academy. But there are three kind of standard criticisms. The first is the problem with the concept of class in Marxism is that the concept is gender blind. That is, the concept of class itself doesn't include any specification of gender relations, whereas class relations are inherently gendered. That's one kind of criticism. Second criticism is that Marxist class analysis tends to reduce gender to class. That is, gender oppression is treated as if it could be fully explained by class oppression. Why do we have gender oppression? Because we have class oppression. typically the because in that explanation will be a functionalist kind of explanation. Why do we have gender oppression? Because it serves certain functions that helps reproduce or deepen or intensify class repression. Note there's exactly the same argument about race. The argument has more face validity for race than for gender. It makes more intuitive sense to say, well, why do we have race oppression? Well, because it serves the interests of the capitalist class. It helps to stabilize class relations. That has a certain plausibility. It's a bit of a stretch to imagine that the reason we have gender inequality is because it serves functions for capitalism, given the history of gender relations and given its rootedness in the micro relations of families and intimacy. But still, it's not a wildly absurd idea that gender oppression takes the form it does because that form is beneficial to capitalism. Note, that's just like the base superstructure kind of argument that we looked at in Cohen. That's the second criticism. The third criticism is that Marxist class analysis treats gender as an epiphenomenon. That is, it's just a surface phenomenon, a symptom of something else, but not itself important in its own right. That's the most extreme kind of criticism. Now, let me just say a word about each of these, because I'm not going to be preoccupied with these throughout these discussions. Working backwards, I don't think anybody ever really said that gender was epiphenomenal, that it was just an appearance and had no reality, had no consequences of its own. And indeed, I mean, this accusation is usually just sloppy. Indeed, it's inconsistent with the second accusation. The form of reductionism in Marxism assigns a lot of importance to the things which are explained functionally. Remember? To say that the superstructure is functionally explained by the economic base doesn't mean the superstructure is irrelevant. It means the superstructure is absolutely essential for the reproduction of the base. It's just that it's explained by virtue of that necessity. So to say that Marxist theory reduces gender to class is to say it treats gender not as an epiphenomenon. You know, so you can't have it both ways. If it's an epiphenomenon, then it's not functionally explained because it's irrelevant. It's just a surface expression. If it's functionally explained, that is a deterministic kind of argument, but it makes it very important, something that really has consequences. So the third criticism, I think, is just sloppy thinking, because I don't think anybody ever says that. The second one is a serious point. I don't think anyone really argues this anymore. There may be arguments that certain aspects of gender relations are to be explained by their functional relevance to capitalism. And that can be part of the kind of explanatory agenda within a gender class analysis. But I think equally one can argue that certain aspects of capitalist class relations are to be explained by their functional relationship to gender. That is, I don't think there's an inherent reason to say only one functional relationship is possible here. There could be a functionalizing of certain aspects of class because of their service for reproducing gender, just as there's a functionalizing of gender because of its usefulness for reproducing class. I think that both of those possibilities should be on the agenda. Finally, on the first thing, I think it's the first criticism, Marxist concepts of class are gender blind. I think that's a correct point, but it's not a criticism. It's a virtue of the Marxist concept of class that it's gender blind, just as it's a virtue of feminist theories of gender that the very concept of gender is class blind. Because I don't think we should build into the concept of gender the class relations in which gender is embedded, and we shouldn't build into the concept of class the gender relations in which it's embedded. We should have a concept of class that identifies a specific set of mechanisms that exist in the world around economic exploitation and domination connected to the distribution of rights and powers over means of production, to give the kind of simplified synoptic statement of the Marxian concept of class. And then we should investigate as thoroughly and deeply as we can how it interconnects, interacts, and is embedded in a structure of social relations that also includes gender relations. If you actually make the concept of class gendered, I think it muddies the analytical tasks and makes it harder to understand the interactions, not easier to understand the interactions of class and gender. Now, if you really take this concept serious, this criticism seriously, if you're not just engaged in a polemical, you know, effort to discredit, if you in this is a serious feminist scholar who is concerned about how to deal with the Marxist perspective. So if it's not just a rhetorical move to discredit the views you're disagreeing with, but it's an actual theoretical proposal, the concept of class should not be gender blind, then you have to propose a new concept. I think the implication of that criticism is that what we need is a concept which I call clender, that is a concept which builds into the very concept the gender and class components. The analogy isn't strictly correct, but it's a bit like saying when you have a concept of water, it shouldn't be oxygen blind. That is, the concept of water needs to have hydrogen and oxygen built into the very concept to really understand how water works. You know, it's a compound. It's not that there's an oxygen effect and a hydrogen effect. There's a water effect on plants. And the water effect on plants is because of the particular form of combination, but the individuality of the separate mechanisms is obliterated by that form of combination. So that with respect to the explanatory purposes to which we use water, if you're discussing plants or whatever, you don't have to make reference to the separate effects of oxygen and the separate effects of hydrogen. You just talk about what happens when you don't give enough water to the plants. Well, if really you want a gendered concept of class, you have a gendered theory of class, you need a gendered concept, which means something like clender. Now, I don't even know what that would mean exactly. I'm not, you know, I haven't played out the proposal in a specific way. But it means that feminists would never be able to talk about gender relations. They would have to talk about clender relations with respect to the social relations that bind together men and women within social relationships. And they would never talk about class relations when they talk about employers and employees. And I just think that becomes unworkable. I think you immediately get into muddles and you have to go through hoops to kind of explain what you're doing. Because ultimately, feminists, just like Marxists, do believe that there are distinct mechanisms at work around class and around gender, and they deeply interact in the empirical contexts where we study them. The focus should be on their deep interaction in the empirical contexts and trying to theorize those interactions, but not obliterate the interaction by fusing the concepts. And that's why I think the gender blindness of the concept of class, not of the theory within which class is deployed, but of the concept, is a virtue, not a problem. Okay? So, just to repeat for these three criticisms, the epiphenomenal criticism is completely wrong-headed. Nobody claims it's an epiphenomenon. The gender-blind one is wrong-headed because it actually would interfere with the analysis of gender and class and their interaction to have a gendered concept of class. And the middle of the three criticisms, the reductionist one, is a serious criticism. You know, there is a real issue there. That's the one where I think there is a real issue. To what extent does one kind of relation bear a functional interconnection with another kind of relation? To what extent does class functionalize gender? It's not exactly a word, functionalize, but you know, render it functional for. To what extent does class functionalize gender? And possibly, to what extent does gender functionalize class? Okay, that's Roman numeral one. Any thoughts or reactions to that cluster of issues? It's all. crystal clear and uncontroversial.
So when you say functionalize, you mean in order to explain a particular phenomena that we're observing, how do class and gender interact?
Not just how do they interact, but to functionalize means there are some aspects of gender which are to be explained by virtue of their beneficial effects for class relations. That would be a functionalization of gender. Now, it would be really a kind of hyperbolic theory that nobody would give credibility to say all aspects of gender are to be explained by their functionality for capitalism. That would be just the kind of, it seems to me, that would be the equivalent. Remember, going back to the historical materialism case, that's the equivalent of a completely inclusive historical materialism that says every single aspect of non-economic relations is to be functionally explained by the benefits they serve to the economic base. Nobody would propose such a theory. So even if you take this functionalist, reductionist kind of program as your way of trying to approach class, it's still always a question of what aspects of gender can be functionally explained by their relationship to class. And some may and some may not. And that becomes then the subtle kind of question, how to, first of all, make that distinction and then how to validate the argument. But it isn't the point I'm just trying to make here in this kind of opening gambit is that it's not a wrong-headed, silly position to take. It's a debatable position to take, and it's an important theoretical kind of context. How should we understand this? Maybe this will help just to clarify this kind of issue. There's a very interesting debate. I referred to it at one place in one of the readings in Class Counts. There was an interesting debate about 19th century capitalism and the coevolution of gender relations and class relations during that century, and particular about the problem of the working class struggles for a family wage. Okay, so this is a site of interconnection between class and gender, because once the family wage is achieved, it stabilizes a family form that allows for a more stably reproduced and deepened gender division of labor in the household and gender division of labor in the labor market, so that you end up, after you get a family wage, with a more coherent pattern of gender hierarchy and class hierarchy than you had before. So it's an important question. How do we understand that transition? So one argument is, the creation of the family wage was a way of functionalizing gender to class. That is, it served the interests of the capitalist class to have a family wage because it made it possible to stably have a system of free labor services provided to workers, which would lower the cost of reproducing labor power. So the free household services provided by women, they're not paid on a market. The free services provided in the house for the reproduction of labor power lowered the cost of reproducing labor power, the argument goes. That's of benefit to capitalism and helps to kind of stabilize the relations of exploitation. That's one kind of argument. Yeah.
On the other hand, though, given that capitalism has a tendency to commodify all aspects of individual life, couldn't it be argued that if you make household functions such as cleaning and cooking and whatnot commodified, isn't that good for capitalism?
Right, absolutely. So that's part of the argument against this view. Okay. So part of the counter argument is that's not obvious. There's all sorts of things that are good for capitalism, and it would be just as good for capitalism, perhaps even better, if you fully commodified every household service. So everybody had to buy their food in fast food restaurants. That seems to have happened. Everybody buys their clothing in retail stores as opposed to makes them at home. That seems to have happened. People buy childcare. That seems to have happened. You know, so the family wage argument, that functional argument, seems a little problematic. The alternative view in the actual historical debate was that men and women in the household had a joint interest in securing the family wage, and that it was a working class victory against the interests of capital to establish a family wage. It's not that it was the functionally optimal. It was compatible with capitalism, but it wasn't the functionally optimal solution for capitalism. But it was a way of the family consolidating its solidarities in a hostile capitalist environment and reducing infant mortality because of the improved quality of early infant child rearing when one family member could devote full time to that. That the family wage allowed for a stabilization of the family, but that was in the interests of workers, not particularly capitalists. Capitalists would have been happy to continue having high infant mortality. You know, that didn't undercut capitalism. So, you know, I'm just saying that there's a debate then around should this be thought of as a functionality with respect to capitalism or just an accommodation where it needs to be functionally compatible. A family wage could only be stable so long as that did not deeply interfere with capital accumulation. And when 100 years later, the dynamics of capital accumulation needed a different kind of labor force, and consumerism became a more deeply embedded component of the expansion of capitalism, when all of these things happened, so that the pressure to commodify what's going on in the household increased, and the pressure to recruit women into the labor force increased, when all of those things began to happen, then the family wage declines. Okay, Roman numeral 2. Visions of emancipation and the challenges of explanation.
Excuse me, do you have another
outline? Yes.
Sorry, actually, I have a question about the feminist critiques. The first one, I just want to make sure I understand it right. You said that class in Marxism is gender blind as a critique, and you defend that as a virtue. But the feminist critique continues in saying that in actuality, class is inherently gendered. Was that
right?
So if class is inherently gendered, I completely get your arguing that gender blindness is actually good for the purposes of analysis, but if it's inherently gendered, it seems to me that it would be ignoring a very important component of...
Right. So I think that sentence is a misstatement. It's not that class is inherently gendered, but that class operates in inherently gendered contexts, so that the effects of class always occur in interaction with gender. The effects of class never happen in a genderless context. So the effects of class always happen through interactions with gender. Now, to be simple about it, for those of you who have had first semester quantitative methods in sociology, think of this as a simple algebraic equation. We'll be discussing this in Roman numeral 4.2 eventually, but let me just prefigure it. A simple algebraic equation where some kind of effect that you're trying to study, poverty or individual income or attitudes or whatever, you're trying to explain something and you want to look at class and gender as components of the explanation. So the simple algebraic equation is this effect, whatever it is you're trying to study, equals some effect of class plus some effect of gender plus an effect of their interaction, which in an equation is a multiplicative term. So you have, you know, B1 times gender plus B2 times class plus B3 times class by gender. So there's three terms in the equation. The argument that class is always inherently gendered and that that's a sufficient way of understanding it would be to say there are no additive effects. That is, all the effects come from the interaction of class and gender. So B1 and B2 are zero. It's a hypothesis that B1 and B2 are zero. And B3 is all the causal processes come through the interaction. The separate mechanisms argument and the separable effects argument says, no, there's an effect of class, there's an effect of gender, and there's an effect of their interaction. Now, you can only even specify that equation if the initial concept is gender blind. Because you wouldn't have a, you couldn't have a separate term for the effects of class. So my view would be, whatever you're wanting to study, if you have women and men on the shop floor of a factory, there are some aspects of the lives of women on the shop floor which are simply the result of the fact that they're employees of a capitalist corporation. There are some aspects of the lives of women on the shop floor are simply the result of the fact that there's gender in the world and they're interacting with men on the shop floor in this complicated dance of gender practices that we live in. But there's some effects that are the result of the precise forms of interaction of those two processes. So that there are some ways in which their promotion possibilities in the firm are not just because there's a class effect and a gender effect, but because there's a very specific kind of promotion process that affects women. So it's a gendered promotion effect, which is the interaction of the two. But I consider that a hypothesis, not a logical necessity. It could be the case that the promotion probabilities for women are simply a consequence of there being some gender effects and some class effects additively affecting their chances, rather than it being an interaction. It could be. It seems to me to claim that it's an interaction is a discovery. It's not a logical deduction. And therefore, as a discovery, it requires data. I mean, you know, we're getting into sort of philosophy of science things here. My general view about this is going to be one of these detours that contributes to us falling behind on our schedule. But it seems worthwhile to add this in at this point. So I think that there are two kinds of moves that we make in the effort to discover things, to deepen our insights and understanding of the world. One is to figure out where the logical derivations are in our theoretical arguments. And the other is to figure out where logical derivation isn't going to give us the answer, but it's going to tell us the question, which we have to study empirically to get the answer. Because there is no inherent logical reason why it has to be one way or the other. The way it is because of the way these forces interact actually in the world, not the way through some theoretical derivation they necessarily interact. Once you make discoveries, you can then say, aha, you know, there really actually is something in the logic of the categories that would have suggested that this is how it would be. And therefore, you can reconstruct the deductive part of your theory in light of your discoveries in a more comprehensive form of logical derivation. That does happen sometimes. You know, a lot of natural sciences works that way, where there's a certain development of a theory. The theory gives you certain very clear expectations about how the world will be, and some non-clear expectations. For the non-clear expectations, what you do is you study the world and see how it actually works as best you can. Once you discover that, you then try to reconstruct the logical model in order to make sense of it. Right, so there's this interplay between, if you will, inductive and deductive moments, rather than saying science has to be one or the other. And that's true here as well. I see the class gender interaction as exactly that kind of problem. Okay. Yeah.
If it turns out empirically that the gender is the driving, is the only, that only B1 has a value and B2 and B3 are zero in the women getting promoted issue, does that present problems then for the privileging of class within historical materialism?
Well, it's so inconceivable that since promotion is itself a class phenomenon, that you could ever imagine it being only a gendered phenomenon, that only gender mechanism. You know, I don't even know quite what it would mean, because it would mean that what we thought was a managerial hierarchy wasn't actually a managerial hierarchy, because to even describe it as a managerial hierarchy requires class terms in it. So I'm not... But there is an example. The chapter in the book on the non-effects of class on the gender division of labor is an example where I had anticipated, on the basis of theoretical arguments, that there would be variations across families, depending upon their class composition, in the gender division of labor within them. So I had thought, you know, there was lots of good arguments of the time in various Marxian and quasi-Marxian traditions of theory that the internal division of labor within households should be affected by the class character of the household. And it turns out to not be the case. As I could not, even though I'm a pretty skilled data analyst, and any self-respecting data analysis should be able to generate an effect even when it doesn't exist. You know, by good manipulation of data, you should be able to show anything you want, right? So I initially embarked on this in a perfectly good faith, ordinary way, didn't get the results. And then I said, okay, let's stretch it. Let me just try to generate these effects by constantly looking at the data and trying to squeeze and put, and you couldn't do it. So that to me was a kind of sensitivity analysis of my non-finding, to show that there wasn't really any plausible way I could generate those effects. Well, to me, that convinced me that it's very unlikely that inside of the family, class effects are very important, that really what's going on is a gender dynamic. As the family unit faces various kinds of constraints, but that the internal class structuring of the family, the fact that husbands may be in a exploiting class position in their jobs and wives not, that the internal class composition of the family just didn't have any effects on the household. So that would be a case where I would say, yes, in the end, for understanding the gender division of labor in the household, you have to understand the gender division of labor of the household. It's a gendered process. It's not a gender plus class process. It's a gendered process. Now, that could be wrong. It could be the result of my measurements. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why my data might have not been good enough. But that's my provisional conclusion based on the empirical investigation. It's way less plausible that you could, that the flip, the symmetrical problem would occur, that you had a workplace problem in which you thought initially that class was important and gender played a role, and it ends up being all gender. You know. Okay, Marxism and feminism. This was a paper that I wrote in the 1980s, you know, Explanation and Emancipation in Marxism and Feminism, which I really liked the paper. I mean, I still like it. I think it was, you know, if you're at this for a long time, there are various pieces that you write where you really felt you learned something by the task of writing it and figuring it out, that you developed some new insights that you hadn't had before. I really liked this paper. I wanted to publish it in New Left Review. I thought it was exactly the kind of things they would publish. And I had published a bunch of things in New Left Review, so I'm one of their authors, as it were. New Left Review is not a peer-reviewed journal in the same sense that an academic journal is. You know, they have an editorial board. They know who submits the papers. And to some extent, they publish work of certain people because they know that the readership wants to hear what that person has to say. You know, so Zizek they publish all the time because they figure people want to hear what Zizek has to say. So I thought, oh, they'd be really eager. They didn't want to publish this paper. So ironically, a paper that I feel in some ways is among my more explicit, you know, papers that's more centrally concerned with core radical political theoretical problems ended up getting published in a mainstream sociological theory journal, the Journal of Sociological Theory. The basic idea of this paper is the following. I regard Marxism as the premier, the predominant tradition of theoretical work to understand class oppression and its transformation. That's the guts of Marxism, is a theory of how harms are generated in the world through their class relations and the process by which those can be transformed. And then a very elaborate theoretical structure has gotten built up around that. But it's basically the theory of class oppression and its transformation. That's what Marxism is. And feminism, as an emancipatory social theory or social science, is the theory of how oppression is built around gender relations and its transformation. That's how I characterize the two traditions. So I reject the view that Marxism is a theory of everything, and the view that feminism is a theory of everything. But it's also the case that Marxism and feminism can study anything from the point of view of the class mechanisms in the case of Marxism or the gender mechanisms in the case of feminism that are implicated in what they study. To use another kind of rhetoric that I've used in some other pieces, both Marxism and feminism are what I call independent variable theories. You know, so they, if you're a Marxist, you study, you study class mechanisms as it applies to any conceivable topic. So you can do a Marxist analysis of architecture, a Marxist analysis of pedagogy, a Marxist analysis of war, a Marxist analysis of poverty. In all cases, what renders it a Marxist analysis is the attention to class and closely connected concepts like capitalism, mode of production, exploitation, right? So Marxism is like endocrinology in medicine, right? Endocrinology is an independent variable discipline in medicine. If you study the hormone system, you can study cancer, pimples, growth, athletic ability. You can study anything you want to, personality, you know, character, emotions, so long as you're studying the effects of the hormone system on those phenomena. Oncology is a dependent variable discipline in medicine. If you're an oncologist, you study cancer. And you can study any cause of cancer. You can be an oncologist who studies environmental pollution, viruses, genetics, smoking, doesn't matter. So long as you're trying to explain the same thing, cancer and its development, you're in oncology. So Marxism is and feminism are like endocrinology, if you will, and a lot of sociology is like cancer. It's an independent Well, that was bad. Don't quote. Of course, it's now on the web. a bad point there. A bit of excessive rhetoric. The point is so that Marxism and feminism each identify a different causal structure that is implicated in a very wide range of phenomena. Now, when you are an independent variable discipline, like Marxism and feminism, you should not be committed to the view that your particular focus of causal mechanism explains everything. And there can be some phenomena within which it turns out your preferred variable, that is, the causal structure that your theory is most coherently developed around, could turn out that it isn't all that important. That was my housework example. I thought that class was going to be important. It turns out, at least as far as I could tell, it certainly wasn't important in the ways I thought it was important. There may be other ways in which it is, but not in the ways that I had thought it was important. Okay, so I characterize Marxism and feminism as emancipatory theories rooted in the analysis of different forms of oppression. Their tasks were to really diagnose those forms of oppression, to see how they work. What are the mechanisms, dynamics, internal structures of those forms of oppression, how they work, and what their effects are in the world on various other things we might care about. Feminists care about poverty. They're concerned with how the feminization of poverty affects the lives of women. But they're more broadly concerned with how the feminization of poverty just affects people, not just how it affects women. It's a gendered process that's shaping the way poverty has developed in the last years, and it affects children as well, and boy children. You know, it's not a womanist perspective, it's a gendered feminist perspective on how that mechanism ramifies in various ways. Both Marxism and feminism, however, are also emancipatory theories. That is, they both posit a world in which their form of oppression is greatly attenuated and normative and ideally disappears. They both have an emancipatory vision. But there's a striking difference between the two. Marxists are continually worried about whether their emancipatory vision is purely utopian, whether it's possible. The idea of a world without class is treated as deeply problematic. A classless society is certainly held as the ideal, it's the vision, but there are very few Marxists, if they're being honest, who can say, yeah, I know for sure that's possible, let alone I know for sure that's going to happen. You know, in the most rhetorically enthusiastic and optimistic visions of some Marxist classics, the possibility of communism is treated as an unproblematic future, the only question being the difficulty of getting there. But really, I think, nobody has a complacent view about the difficulty of staying there, of actually what the institutional designs are of a world without class inequalities. And when you really think about it, what does it even exactly mean to have a world without class inequalities? Even that isn't totally transparent, but even aside from that. So the debates about socialism, about the kinds of institutions you would need, about central planning versus democratic decentralization, should there be markets or not markets, lots and lots of debate about the structure of the alternative. Therefore, within the Marxist tradition and more broadly the socialist tradition of emancipation, that is emancipation built around class inequality, there's the continual worry about the macro institutional forms which would realize that ideal and make it sustainable. It's not taken for granted. And it's a major focus of political and theoretical debate. Now, in gender, with respect to feminism, there is not that kind of discussion. There's a virtual absence of discussion of the problem of what an egalitarian society in which gender oppression had disappeared would look like, and whether there would be any difficulty in sustaining it. What kinds of institutions would establish and reinforce and prevent the deterioration of egalitarianism around gender issues? In the gendered case, the theory is as if all you need to do is struggle against male domination. You just have to destroy that in order to get what you want. That's equivalent to the kind of Marxian view, smash first, build later, right? The idea that all you have to do is destroy capitalism and then socialism will come about. That the only problem was the struggle against problem, not the build for problem. Now, socialists no longer believe that, or most don't. They realize that the building for problem is a huge one, and that the struggle against without the building for can lead to all sorts of perverse effects. That kind of issue is not present in the feminist discussion. Now, the question then is why? So can we explain why there's a silence on the utopian moment? When I've taught my course on envisioning real utopias, which I teach every few years, when I teach that course, I've often wanted to have good feminist literature on feminist visions of real utopia. I can find some in science fiction. There's this very good feminist science fiction. Most of it, I mean, most feminist science fiction is either dystopic, you know, it's about hyper developed, you know, perverse forms of male domination, like The Handmaid's Tale. You know, it's a wonderful book. Well, that's not science fiction. That's just sort of futuristic. Or they muck about with biology. You know, so there's some wonderful science fiction, really interesting science fiction around gender egalitarian worlds, but in which the key transformation that's in place is biological. If you haven't read it, The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, it's a terrific book. I mean, it's a great story. So the setup is a spaceman, man from Earth, gets marooned on some distant planet, which has the following human-type creatures. They look exactly like us, so they're completely recognizable. But there are no genders and no sexes. Everybody is androgynous, but on a monthly cycle, they become either a man or a woman. So they have a cycle, a biological cycle, in which their sexual reproductive organs develop in response to whatever cycle. If they're in a paired relationship with another person, then whoever's cycle begins first triggers the complement. So some months you're a man and some months you're a woman during your reproductive cycle, which means you're the father of some of your children and the mother of others. So they have no concept of gender roles. There's no stability. They do understand sexuality, of course, and they understand the binary character of sexuality, but only in the same kind of sense that if you take turns cooking meals, there's the chef and there's the eater, you know, so to speak, in a meal. There's a temporary relation. Now, in that society, the worst, most disgusting form of perversion is to take drugs, there are medical ways, of fixing your sex. So somebody who would want to be only male or only female is seen as really disgusting. That's just seen as a horrific violation of nature. You know, in much the same way that certain strands of homophobia see it as a violation of the natural, right? So here's this poor Earthman who arrived through no fault of his own. He is a man permanently. He can't do anything about it. And at first, people are just horrified. They just really find it kind of gross. But then they understand that he comes from a different biological system, and so it's really not anything that he has responsibility over. But he does have this problem that he falls in love with someone, which forces his partner to be a permanent woman. Right? So you can see, it's a cool, it's an interesting story. It tells, and it's very revealing about gender, but how does it get at the egalitarian thing? By mucking about with biology. It's a fundamentally asocial view of gender domination. Because the core of feminism is that gender relations are a transformation of biological sex into social categories. And that that transformation is a social process. It's not a biological process. That is, gender is not merely a reflection of biology. It's a social construction, which is the usual word. I would say social transformation, seems to me, makes it more kind of analogous to the class problem of relations. So just as class is a social transformation of the cooperative division of labor within a complex task into relations of domination and exploitation, gender is a transformation of biological difference into a socially constructed difference.
Question.
Yeah.
Wouldn't, just not that I agree with him, but say Judith Butler as that, wouldn't, in line with that sort of feminism, that since sexuality itself is already a social production, that sexuality is not, this biological given, that the destruction of gender relations, that she doesn't want to build anything up, so wouldn't that necessarily separate itself in its emancipatory vision from Marxism? That they don't want necessarily a build for, they just want a struggle against, and once you defeat those.
But that's an illusion, that you could have a genderless society without institutions to reproduce genderlessness. No, it's just like you can't have a classless society without institutions to reproduce classlessness. It doesn't require the view that gender oppression is somehow biologically given to argue that whatever social form biology takes requires social relations to reproduce. To say that it doesn't implies that genderlessness is somehow natural, self-reproducing once you get there. And that the only thing that isn't natural are gender binaries transformed on biological difference. And to me, that's an incoherent position. If gendered binaries are socially constructed, so would degendered binaries be socially constructed. They wouldn't be binaries if they were degendered non-binaries. That would also be socially constructed in the sense that it still takes social work, culture, ideology, rules of the game, perhaps incentives, who knows what it is. But it would be an issue that at least deserves, one would think, some kind of thought. Now, my point here, this is not by way of a criticism of feminism for not paying attention to something that needs to be paid attention to. Perhaps it doesn't need to be paid attention to as much as in Marxism. Because perhaps there's a macro problem for the reproduction of class, the dissolution of class, perhaps there's a macro-institutional problem that isn't present for gender. So for the class context, there's a recognized problem that we are going to have a lot of complexity, and we need to have mechanisms to coordinate this complexity in order for social reproduction to take place. You have a complex division of labor, you have inputs and outputs from around the world, you have to somehow bring this all together. Markets do that, that's one way of doing it. Markets tend to produce classes. If you're going to get rid of classes, you're going to need some other kind of mechanism to do it. You might still need markets, how can you prevent them from being producing classes again. So you need some kind of state planning machinery that's going to neutralize the class inequalities generated, and it suddenly gets real complicated. I think that for feminism, the reason why they don't worry about this problem is because they don't believe there's a macro social problem of coordination that would need to be solved in the face of increasing moves towards the dissolution of gender. They feel that there may be all sorts of obstacles, but that there isn't any kind of macro reproduction problem. So you don't have to worry about the overall institutional architecture. That the main thing you have to worry about is cultural transformation, and then perhaps the institutions which will help sustain that. So you might need different curricula in schools, and you might need different child-rearing practices and their reflection in nursery schools. You know, so you'll need different socialization, but and you need to get rid of certain kinds of incentives, labor market inequalities, for example. But once you've done that, then it will be a self-reproducing system without needing macro coordination. And that's why you don't have to attend so much to this problem of the emancipatory vision. Yeah.
So basically the idea then is that it's more like the imperative for social change in feminism, you're saying then is more categorical then ethically, that like they want to like the basis, so because institutions are fundamentally like designed, that means there is some intentional process going on there in the design of institutions. So in order to have a truly emancipated society, the development of institutions has to be ethically, or there's some more categorical basis for the design of institutions than just institutions developed in this particular way, and therefore these effects are realized, and that's how we realize we need emancipation. Right, so that there's an opposition between those two.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I think that both feminists and Marxists have a deep moral commitment to the elimination of oppressions, and there's no foundational difference. There's a difference in the object of their concerns, but not in their core underlying moral commitment to. Individual human flourishing under conditions of egalitarian and democratic cooperation. You know, I think that's the guts of a feminist and mutual recognition. And you know, there's a lot you have to add to this to make it fully elaborated. I think the difference is the nature of the conditions for the reproduction of emancipation are seen as different. In the feminist case, it's seen as largely micro in character. In the Marxist case, it's seen as largely macro in character, as where the problem lies. Furthermore, I think in feminism, and this may be a little more controversial, I think because gender inequality is experienced so sharply at the micro level in everyday life, it's also the case that the prefigurative forms of equality are experienced sharply in everyday life. It is possible for individuals to forge highly egalitarian relations around gender in their enclosed private spheres, and that's been increasingly the case as the outside environment is less hostile to people forging their own alternatives. So just as in my envisioning real utopias, I argue for the crucial importance of interstitial transformation where you build alternatives in the here and now. Around gender, people are doing that all the time. And it's part of the lived experience of people to either get glimpses or more full bore experiences of what a symmetrical relationship between men and women is like, and what values and ways of life it would constitute. There is way more variation across households, for example, in the gender division of labor in households than there is across firms in the class division of power. Right? So capitalist firms universally have employees and owners where the power resides in the owners. It almost never happens that you have a capitalist firm where the owner says, yes, I own the firm, but I give all responsibility to the workers to decide what to do and how to do it. You know, without me interfering at all. It's not, that has happened, extremely rare. But in roughly 30% of American households, husbands do more housework and childcare than their wives. That's a pretty high percentage, 25%, you know, somewhere around a quarter. You know, that's not 50%, but it's not 1%. You know, it's and that's a change over time. So I think that what's in play here is that that gender relations has this more, it's more anchored in the micro relations of personal interaction. It's not that those micro relations aren't themselves reproduced by macro structures, but the macro structures play the role of reproducing these micro structures. And as the possibility of transforming the micro occurs, I think the general view in feminism, the intuition is that the cumulative effect, the aggregate effect of a spreading of micro transformations, interstitial transformations, is the transformation of the macro. There isn't an autonomous problem of reproducing new macro institutions. That's, in a sense, endogenous to the interstitial problem of transforming the specifics. Now, that may be wrong. So I can tell you, I can give you a scenario where, just as in socialism, there's the fear that you'd have economic collapse if you got rid of markets and class inequalities, that the class inequalities are absolutely essential to the incentives needed to provide effective coordination in markets. If you combine markets with central planning, you get a perverse combination that self-destructs. It can't work. If you have central planning without markets, the economy stagnates and eventually gets overwhelmed with corruption and, you know, rent seeking. And so, for better or worse, the best we can do is class inequality in markets. Okay, so that's the reason why socialists worry about this, that you might have economic decay under non-capitalist conditions. There is a story you can tell about why you'd have a non-sustainable problem under conditions of egalitarian relations around gender. And it's basically that you'd end up with demographic collapse. That the reason why, on average, people are prepared to have children at all, and perhaps two children, I mean, you know, to avoid demographic collapse in a steady state world, couples have to have, on average, 2.2 or whatever it is, children. If you have one child per couple, that's not a steady state. You'll have demographic collapse eventually, right? So the argument would be, it's all well and good to talk about gender equality, but in the end, if you don't have the bodies that are responsible for gestation having an identity connected to the reproduction of the species, you know, so that motherhood is a distinct biologically rooted identity. If that identity gets weakened in the call for symmetry, that fathers are just the same as mothers, that there's really no difference, then the gestational carriers are not going to have the incentive to go through it sufficiently. That is, the distribution of that incentive that's going to remain in the degendered society is going to be too low for demographic reproduction. Therefore, you'll need to have institutions to create incentives to have children. You'll need specialized institutions whose purpose is to encourage people to have children, because they're not going to want to have enough children to keep the population at a steady state. You can say, well, ecologically it'd be good to have a decline of population, but not demographic collapse. That may be good for the planet, but it isn't good for social reproduction to have demographic collapse. So it's possible. I'm not advocating this position, mind you. I think the motivations for having children are sufficiently strong for both men and women that under egalitarian conditions, if particularly it's combined with class egalitarian conditions, so that people's lives can be ordered in ways that they can manage the time stresses of children and work and so forth in a much more humane way, I think the problem will not be a problem, that there will be enough people for whom having a family with two or three children will be considered the ideal way for their life plans to be put into effect, that you would have a stable demography possible under completely egalitarian conditions. That's my expectation. But that could be wrong, right? That's not based on any strong factual evidence. It's based on my intuitions from introspection about my own life and my sense about what people are like. But since I don't know what people would be like under a new regime of degendered social relations, that expectation could be wrong. And if it is wrong, then you'll need specific macro institutions designed to maintain demographic possibilities. And those will be tricky. It's going to be tricky to create those institutions in a way that also reproduces the equality. Yeah?
I mean, do contemporary feminist scholars argue for the emancipatory vision as being degendered? I mean, there's a difference between, like class as a, as a relation between the practices of individuals. It's a relational concept we discussed. Gender, isn't it? Especially after the third wave, the concern over gender being an identity that's performed. It's not so clear that these two things can be, put on the same level of understanding as being like an emancipatory vision of feminism would then be a degendered society.
Right. So this is an extremely interesting issue. What exactly is the emancipatory vision? Is it gender equality or is it degendering, post-gender society? So think about it with respect to race. Is the goal of race emancipation around race, racial equality or a deracialization of society? That is, racial division no longer has any salience whatsoever. It's not that it's a salient division in society, but it's just that it's equal. It just doesn't have any salience anymore. Now, I think deracialization is clearly the emancipatory goal for race. That is, for race, it's not that you want people to have strong racial divisions. It's just you want it to be equal. You don't want racial division. You don't want anybody to think if a white marries a black that they're somehow violating some identity, that this is somehow, there's any normative baggage brought to whatever relations people forge around that distinction. It doesn't mean that certain physical characteristics wouldn't be noted about people. We do that all the time. We're very good with face recognition. It's part of our software that is incredibly well developed. But it wouldn't have any normative salience, I think, for me. Now, that's different from ethnicity. There's this important distinction between race and ethnicity. And of course, in the United States, because of the historical and cultural embeddedness of race, African Americans are also an ethnic category. It's not just a racial category. It's an ethnicity. Ethnic identity is very different. We have people of Italian and Irish descent in the United States, and Polish and Jamaican, and they have distinctive foods and holidays and celebrations and family traditions, which are part of what makes life pleasurable and creates a sense of continuity with your forebearers and a sense of how you want your children. But that's the cultural face. It's not the racial aspect. The addition of a racial aspect to the ethnicity, I think, contaminates. That's a kind of harsh word. Contaminates the authenticity of the cultural form. In my view of an emancipated society is that ethnic identities would be just fine. They're like musical tastes. You have country music. There's some people for whom classical music functions in their identity the same way being Italian does for others. Right? It organizes their ritual life, their forms of celebration, their cultural interchange with family and friends. So ethnicity becomes like music. It's part of one's cultural construction of a personal identity embedded in a community and network of kinship and friends. A world without that would be terrible. A world in which everything is homogenized, I don't know what the generic term for that kind of salient cultural identity. But I think the racialized component just mucks it up. And is always, where it's salient, associated with forms of exclusion. whereas these other identities need not be. All right, what should we do? Is it too unbearable if we just carry through without a break? Do you want to, I don't mean to be mean here. I was going to make another little digression here, just this, as the spirit moved me, but we're not making a hell of a lot of progress. Should we take a five minute break? Okay, let's take a quick 5 minute break. I was going to do a digression. I think the virtue of having taken a break is that it also reduced my urge to another digression around the particular things we were talking about. All right, so the point on the, just to wrap up the Marxism, feminism, emancipatory theory discussion, which is the Roman numeral two, there is the possibility that gender emancipation faces a problem of macro institutional reproduction. The most plausible site for that would be the issue of demography. That then triggered the comment about what the ideal is. Is it genderlessness or is it gender equality? I think that's an extremely interesting discussion. I think it hinges on whether you see gender as a social relation or just an identity. Right? So I treat gender as a social relation, meaning gender relations define roles that bind together the lives of men and women. It's a transformation of the biological difference between men and women into a social relation where there are mutually recognized expectations about the appropriate roles and behavior, normatively enforced, in some times and places enforced by more than norms, about what's the appropriate thing for women to do and the appropriate thing for men to do. That is, to take the biological category, males should do, males and females, and turn them into men and women bound together in relations of mutual recognition, so mutual expectations. From those relations then get derived identities. People are socialized to fill those roles. They have developed identities which are also gendered. Now, I think in terms of the relational aspects of gender, a degendering of society is the normative ideal. We want a genderless society in the same way we want a classless society, that there is symmetry there. That is, it should not be the case that a person born a biological man, there's any particular expectation as to what roles that person should fulfill with respect to the biological social connection. There's no reason why it should be any weirder for a biological man to be a stay-at-home parent than a biological woman to be a stay-at-home parent. That should be one of the possibilities. And it should be not regarded as violating any normative expectation. If we live in a world where it doesn't violate any normative expectation for a biological man to be a stay-at-home parent or to put parenting above work or any other thing, if that doesn't violate any normative expectation, that is a degendered society. That means there are no longer gender relations. Now, there could still be what we would now call, but I think might be somewhat of a misnomer, gender identities. One way of thinking about that is there's some distribution among biological men and biological women in various kinds of dispositions. Some of these dispositions are biologically anchored, right? So there may be, because of what seems to be the case about testosterone as a kind of hormone, which is a biologically rooted phenomenon, although not purely biological. Testosterone levels in men depends upon social relations, turns out. That is, men who are active parents have lower levels of testosterone than men who are not.
Nice.
Right, so it's not the case. I mean, this is a really important point. You know, it's a kind of foundational point. The fact that a mechanism is biological doesn't mean that it's it biologically determines anything. It's true that testosterone is connected to aggressiveness, right? I think that's unequivocal. It's not true that the testosterone levels in men is just simply a function of the fact that they're men. It's a function of the social relations in which their lives are embedded. That men who are daddies, taking care of little babies, get a kind of, there's a hormone effect of that that is powerful and changes their nature. You know, nurture changes nature. It's not just that there's nature and nurture. Nurture changes nature. Yeah?
Did they do any sort of longitudinal study to prove that, to determine it wasn't just self-selecting that men make
lower? Right, so I don't know the answer to that. Well, they do know that it's a change in the particular man. That is, they have done that, but they don't. But it still could be self-selection. There still could be. It could be the case that men whose testosterone levels are for whatever underlying mechanisms, will go down when they nurture, are more likely to nurture, than men for whom that wouldn't be true. So it could be that if you're a man for whom it is not true that your testosterone levels would go down if you nurture, you'd find it so dreadfully frustrating to nurture that you'd be a lousy nurturer, and therefore you'd get kicked out of the job, as it were. So it's possible that there is a sensitivity fit issue here. You know, that could be another part of the complexity of these things. My normative vision then would be that, so let's use the word masculine and feminine rather than male and female or man and woman to describe the underlying dispositional qualities. That the distribution within biological men and biological women of masculine and feminine dispositions will be partially affected by underlying biological processes, but also heavily affected by the social relations in which they're embedded. That it will not be the case that people who currently feel highly feminine identities or highly masculine identities, as if these were organic to them, would have the same mix of identities under conditions in which they were in egalitarian relations, where nurturance and aggressive activity, so to speak, were part of everybody's ordinary repertoire. But still, I think there probably would be differences. You know, I have no reason to suspect that the distributions within biological men and women would be identical under egalitarian conditions. I just think they would be much less different than they appear to be now. The overlap would be huge. One would expect in a degendered world there would be more mothers than fathers, because it's logistically vastly easier for women to be single parents than for men, right? Whatever else is the case, a biologically fertile woman can become a mother in a way that a man has to make big arrangements to become a father. And the arrangements would require the intervention of social institutions in a way that isn't the case for women. So my prediction would be, on that basis alone, there would be more mothers than fathers, more single mothers than single fathers in the world. And that means that probably there'd be more mothers. That is, more people engaged in the activity of mothering than there are people engaged in what we would call the act, or to say it even more precisely, there'd be more women engaged in the activity of parenting, active parenting, than men engaged in the activity of active parenting, since the mother-father terms refer to role differences, which would now be dissolved. But I think that could be a stable and small difference, and that it's not a difference that would justify calling it a gender relation. Okay, so that's... All right. We must move on. Yeah?
Are you saying that there's a problem with this idea of degendering?
Well, some people are fixed on this notion of gender difference. So there are difference feminists who are very uncomfortable, I think because they are not clear in their thinking about this. I mean, I do think this is a case of lack of completely clear and coherent theoretical understanding. But there are feminists, sometimes called feminists of difference, who want gender equality and full recognition of gender difference as the normative goal. But I think it's confused, because it ultimately mistakes sex and gender. I think. It doesn't recognize that many biological men are more, have dispositions that are more feminine than many biological women. And so the point is, of course, full recognition of this range of dispositions. There's no, that the feminine and the masculine would be just two different ways of being, just like being more artistic or being more athletic. I mean, there are many women who are more athletic than most men, and increasingly the distributions of athleticism. It's not that there are many women who are stronger than the strong than strong men. That's a biological difference. The same for height. You know, those seem to be pretty biologically rooted. But there are many women who are way more athletic than the median man, and that the difference in athleticism between men and women has declined dramatically in the last generation. And my prediction would be that difference would disappear entirely. There's absolutely no underlying difference in biology which would explain less athleticism. There's less part of one's identity and joie de vivre being bound up with sports of whatever sort. I was an honorary coach for the women's basketball team for a day and for the men's football team for a day. That's one of the things that happens to you if you teach undergraduate, big undergraduate courses, that the athletes in your class can choose you to be their honorary coach for a day. So I got to sit on the, I got to sit on the bench of the women's basketball team a few years ago and the last year on the male football team. And there was, as far as I could tell, you know, the complete bodily commitment to what they were doing as athletes was absolutely the indistinguishable. You know, it was completely joyful to be part of both of these subcultures for the time I was. I don't know, that's another, I don't know if that's an answer to what you Okay. So, let's move on to the interactions of class and gender. The interactions of class and gender, then, should be understood, in my view, that we have two different causal processes that exist in the world. They have their own foundations. They're rooted in different aspects of social practice, social relations. We have class relations and class practices, gender relations and gender practices. And they interact in concrete settings. That there is no concrete setting whatsoever in which there are only class practices and relations going on. It just isn't the case that gender practices and relations in various ways doesn't impinge on every single possible setting. That doesn't mean that it plays much of an explanatory role with respect to whatever it is you might be trying to explain, but it's always present. They're always co-present in every setting. Our task, then, is to understand the forms of interaction. This is both a micro and a macro problem. At the micro level, this involves understanding the lived experiences of people, how individuals acquire the understanding about how they occupy locations within gender relations as well as class locations. A location, remember, is a location within a relation. That is, what we mean by a location is being subjected to relationally interacting practices of various sorts. You are in the student location within the classroom relations. You're being subjected, by virtue of being located in that way, to a set of interacting practices. You are participants in these practices. It's not just that you're a thing out there being filled by my words. This is an interaction process. It's possible to be a student and not pay any attention whatsoever, not hear a single word, and be completely insulated from the interacting practices of a classroom, after all. The same is true for class and gender. So when people insist that race and gender are important, often they are mostly making this micro point. That is, they're saying that everybody is constantly, in their lives, being subjected to the interactional practices of race and gender as well as class, which shapes the character of their lived experiences, their identities, and the way they operate in the world. So often, the intersectionality thesis is really a micro intersectionality thesis about the nature of experience. At the macro level, there's significant variation in the forms of gender relations and class relations across societies or any other unit of analysis. So the micro practices which and experiences which people have are embedded in relations, but different units of analysis consist of different aggregations of those relations. And that macro description then matters in its own right, and it matters for the micro experience. It matters, for example, if you're a stay-at-home father, whether you're a stay-at-home father in a community like Madison, where probably 10% of households have stay-at-home fathers, or if you're in a community where 0.1% do. 10% is probably still below the threshold for it to become a normatively visible category, but it's above the threshold where it's viewed as deviant and stigmatized. You know, it's an accepted role in the Madison context. That's probably in the development of gender relations over the last 50 years, a crucial threshold was passed when being a stay-at-home mom in the 50s meant that there were dozens of stay-at-home moms within walking distance that you could drop off your kids and have coffee in the morning. There was a kind of whole community of stay-at-home moms in every city, which meant that there was much less sense of isolation, much more sense of social support, and it meant that the role was easier to do because of the horizontal connectedness among stay-at-home moms. In the contemporary context, where that's much less the case, and in some contexts almost not at all, it means that a stay-at-home mom becomes much more isolated, which makes it a harder role to fulfill. So the macro relations of that gendered structure of the division of labor affects the micro experience. The micro experience is not just the experience of you as a separate person within your own location within those relations, but it's a function of the whole structure of those relations. So that's the kind of macro side of it. How then should we understand the interrelationship of class and gender? I break this problem into two three parts. One, two big parts, and then one has a separate part. One is the effects of class and gender on each other. That's one set of problems. That has two sub-problems. How does class affect gender? How does gender affect class? And the second is the joint effects of class and gender in explaining various things. So there are things other than class and gender that we explain by class and gender. That is, by explain by, I mean that we study by examining the effects of class on and gender on the thing in question. So it's important to understand the Tea Party and changes in the ideological dispositions in the American electorate. And we can ask what are the class effects and gender effects on Tea Party participation. We can ask that as a micro problem by looking at class and gender of voters and of adults' attitudes towards the Tea Party. We can treat it as a macro problem. How does class relations affect the funding for the Tea Party, and how do gender relations affect the funding for the Tea Party? So for the macro problem, it seems to me class is vastly more important than gender. For the micro problem, it looks like gender may be as important, if not more, than class. The Tea Party is much more supported by white men and the race problem, too. But it's a disproportionately male phenomenon and white male phenomenon. But in terms of where the funding for the Tea Party comes, it seems to me the gender issue has relatively little to do with it. It's primarily a function of very rich people channeling money to extreme right-wing forms of American politics. That's class and gender explaining something, as opposed to the effects of class on gender and the effects of gender on class. We've already discussed some of these things. Let me just briefly, I'm trying to think of how much to shave off of this as usual. Let's go through each of these and just see where it takes us. Okay, so the first of these problems is, how do we think about the effects of gender on class? How do gender relations affect class? So what do you think? If you've read the material, you'll have seen, since I do discuss this in the chapter, but what are your thoughts on this? How, if somebody were to ask you, how does gender affect class? What are the sorts of things you would talk about? Give me an example of the way gender affects class. Anybody?
Mediated class locations.
So one way gender shapes class is that gender affects your connection to class via your family structure. That's the family-based mediated class. That's one way. Gender affects class by affecting how you as a person are tied to the class structure via your family structure, which is what the main example of mediated class locations that I've used. Other ways that gender affects class. Yeah.
Shadow class?
So shadow class, yes, sure. So gender would affect the temporal connection to the class structure through the way gender relations are bound up with the dissolution and formation of families. The shadow class being something that's relevant to both men and women, but particularly salient to married women.
Perceived job opportunities or career paths?
Well, both perceived and actual.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Right, so gender clearly affects the probabilities of a person getting into a particular class location. Right. So without specifying what the mechanism is, just as an empirical description, we know the probability of a woman becoming a top manager is lower than the probability of a man becoming a top manager. Now, it's possible, of course, that differential in probabilities could be entirely the result of self-selection. We don't know in advance of studying it whether the different probability of a woman becoming a top manager is because in the managerial structure there's some discrimination against women, some barrier that makes it harder for women to get promoted, or whether the mechanisms involved in that empirical description operate entirely through the identities of men and women, so that women don't do the things they need to do to get promoted because they have other priorities, which still is a gendered process. Why is that true for women more than for men? That means it is a gendered process. But it's not a gendered process located interior to the promotion structure, at least not in the simplest of ways, bias against women. It could be located in the promotion structure in the sense of the inflexibility of those structures to deal with the time binds or the conflicting pressures that a woman is likely to be under, so that her opting out of that competition may be because of the rigidity of the structure. Which means if that's true, it's incorrect to call that self-selection. It's a misdiagnosis to call it self-selection, because it's self-selection by virtue of the particular conditions of the selection process, of the promotion process, which are not inherent, right? So it's one thing to say that there's self-selection of short people to not compete for basketball but to go for baseball, you know, in high school sports, right? Because there's an intrinsic advantage to being tall in basketball. And because we don't have basketball teams that are height graded, we have gender graded, differentiated basketball teams, but not height graded. We could have leagues in high school that are like in boxing. In boxing, we have weight-graded competition because we realize it's ridiculous to have a heavyweight and a welterweight fight each other. You know, it's an unfair fight with respect to the objectives of the sport, which are to have a fight in which the skill of the athlete and their training is what determines the differential chances of winning. So if we didn't differentiate weight classes in wrestling and boxing, there would only be the heavyweight class. The other sports would disappear. There wouldn't be small people engaged in boxing. We could do that for basketball. I was going to say that in the basketball case, you could call it self-selection. No, it's not true. It's because of the way we socially organize our basketball competitions. We could have a basketball league that says you have to be 6 feet or above, or just an unbelievably talented 5'8" person who can jump 9 feet. You know, there are the Bugs, what is it, Muggsy Bowes. There are the Muggsy Bowes, the 5'6" NBA players who... he basically could sort of skittle underneath between the legs of the other players, who were so low they couldn't see him. So we could have, right. So even for basketball, you know, the fact that short high school kids go out for baseball rather than basketball isn't just self-selection. It's because we haven't organized basketball competition as a height-graded sport, which would be a perfectly legitimate alternative way of organizing basketball, just like. In weight. Okay, so all of this is all the effects of gender on class. I think the way to think about it broadly is that gender affects how people get allocated to class relations, to class positions. It's a clearly potent allocator, and the mechanisms are some combination of socialization and identity so that women and men are socialized into different expectations as to what the appropriate kinds of roles for them to be are. That's a difference that's weakened over time. It's clear that there are many more kinds of jobs and occupations which women feel perfectly comfortable identifying with. It's weakened much more on the side of women than men, although that's changing as well. There are many more male nurses now than there was a generation ago, for example. So there's some highly feminized occupations that have been somewhat defeminized by the entry of men. Even early childhood education, you know, preschool. There are more male preschool teachers now than there was a generation ago, although that changes less. The occupation that is the most gendered and which hasn't budged at all, it's dental hygienists. You know, that's the single, at least at the level of the three-digit occupation codes, it's the single most sex-segregated occupation. There is no male, it's 98.2% women. There is no male occupation which is 98.2% men now. Airline pilot is like 95% men. There are 5% of women, of airline pilots are women. Auto mechanics, I think it's 93 or 4% men. There's nothing as high as dental hygienists. Gender also, though, affects. So gender affects the allocation of people to class, and gender affects both the indirect connections to class through families. And then there's all sorts of mechanisms that you'd have to study to see how does gender do this. Discrimination is certainly a big one, but identity formation is also important. But gender also affects the nature of the class locations themselves. Some classes, some kinds of job locations, which are located then within the class structure in a particular way, would not have existed or would have existed in very different ways in the absence of strong gender relations. It's been argued, for example, that because of the inheritance rules in farming in 19th century United States in New England, there was a huge labor supply of unmarried daughters in rural communities who were available for textile work, whereas there was not nearly the labor supply of men in a still largely agrarian society. So the rapid emergence of textile manufacturing in that context was dependent upon the gender relations within the self-employed, you know, petty bourgeois agrarian communities, which made available all these unmarried women. So women would work in the textile mills from age 15 to 25 and then get married and typically leave the textile mills at that point. They would get married to they'd go back to agriculture, at least in the early part of the Industrial Revolution. All right, I think we are at Roman numeral 4:2. Well, the rest of this lecture is probably about half a lecture. So we will finish this and start race next on Wednesday and finish off this part of the class probably on next Monday, and then turn next week into turn to the problem of class formation. I will be at Espresso Royale at 8:30 next Wednesday. Oh, I want to remind everybody, Joran Terborn, you're going to be reading two of his books. So he's going to be here this week giving lectures at the Haven Center and doing a seminar on Thursday. The lectures on the Haven Center are looking back at these books 30 years later. It's a kind of retrospective on what does the ruling class do when it rules and the power of ideology and the ideology of power. So I super recommend you go to these lectures and use the opportunity also to meet with him individually. He's a very interesting and thoughtful person, and this is a chance to talk to the books you're going to read. Okay, see you next on Wednesday. Great.
Can you talk about the Congress?
Sure. Can you come to the office hours on...